Selling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Now, it's time to go deep for the exclusive info you need on the hockey team you love. This is Preds Insiders with your host, Ryan Porth.
Brought to you by Dr. Kelly Rice.
On your flagship home of the Predators Radio Network, Smashville's best sports talk.
ESPN.
102.5 The Game.
Welcome into Preds Insiders here on this Monday evening. ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Ryan Porth here, joined by Willie Donick, co-host of Darren Donick and Chase, weekdays 10 to 2, ESPN 102.5 The Game, and also the TV voice of the Nashville Predators. Willie, how we doing this evening?
Doing well. I'm running on adrenaline. As the saying goes, you sleep when the playoffs are over.
That is for sure. And I know my my vocal cords are running on adrenaline at this point as well, as I'm sure our listeners can hear. Sometimes, Willie, you just get wrapped up in the moment. And I was already going into Sunday with a not 100% voice box. And then, you know, then they decided to go to double overtime again. So sometimes you just get wrapped in the moment. But we'll power through with the vocal cords here, even though not 100%. So speaking of, Friday night goes double overtime with Matt Duchene scoring the double overtime winner. And I do want to get to that and that moment for him specifically here in a few minutes. But Luke Cunnan scores 57 seconds into the game yesterday. He almost scores a second time. And then and that was like 1 minute after his game-opening goal. And then he's the hero in double overtime on a really good just offensive zone cycle by the Predators that ended up with Luke Cunnan wide open in the slot after he had to go back to the bench to retrieve a stick from Pete Rogers. He comes into the offensive zone and snaps home a one-timer, a nice pass from Mikael Granlund, and Smashville just goes bonkers. And Willie, I mean, that moment yesterday, I think when you couple that with what happened Friday night, one of the coolest 48-hour time periods inside that arena.
Yeah, I think when you put it that way, you know, coolest 48 hours, it's right up there. And I just thought that there were very few stanzas in either game that lacked action, right? There are some games that go for a long time, but they hit a point where nobody's really taking chances. But I'll tell you, just to watch both teams empty the tanks the way they did, it was really something to see. And then all the bells and whistles around it with the atmosphere in the arena and Taylor Lewan and Mike Fisher and Carrie Underwood and the fans with the standing O's, it was just really a special environment. And because maybe we missed it a little bit, you know, in the last, you know, 13 months or whatever it's been, maybe it was even more special because of that.
Sure. Well, not only more special because everybody had maybe a little pep in their step walking into Bridgestone Arena knowing it was the playoffs, but also I think a sense of appreciation that, you know, even if it's not 100%, you know, 12 plus thousand being able to be inside Smashville for those two games was certainly very, very cool for everyone who was able to experience that. And, you know, this double overtime goal yesterday, we're about to hear from Pete Weber. I never got the sense, really, unlike Friday night, that either team was super close to scoring. It was very much a chess match between the Preds and the Canes in the first couple of overtimes. And yes, there were chances, but there weren't a lot of traded chances between the two teams. Very much a chess match until this moment from Luke Cunnan as called on the Fifth Third Bank Nashville Predators Radio Network.
Here's Josi alongside into the corner right side. Yarncroak on the right half board to the left wing corner.
Fed on it front for Cunnan to score. Luke Cunnan wins it in overtime. Predators have tied the series at two wins each.
All right, that was Pete Weber on the call. Willie, you had a great call as well on the TV side of things and mentioned that Cunnan opened the game with a goal. He ends the game with a goal. I believe it's the fourth longest amount of time between two goals by a player in the same game in NHL history, as 95 minutes and 13 seconds elapsed between Cunnan's first goal of the game and his second goal of the game. Mike Fisher actually has the third longest back in 2016 game four against San Jose. But Luke Kunin,
we remember that game.
Oh, that one goes in the history books, and so do these last two for games three and four. Luke Kunin, Willie, feel like ever since he returned from injury has been fantastic. I mean, he had 14 points in the last 21 regular season games, and he had two clutch goals against the Hurricanes in the playoff clincher on May 8th. And then last night, or yesterday afternoon, I should say, two goals. Luke Kunin has really come into his own here in the last, I would say, 2 months.
And I think it goes with a trend of what's happened to a number of players this year when either they rotate out because they haven't played well, or they get injured, as is the case for Kunin a couple of times. Remember, he was injured twice. And on the second time, when he came back, the team had started to play well, and they didn't really have a spot for him. But then Philip Forsberg got hurt. He's able to take advantage of that, jump right in, and he's been a different player. So the next man up thing has been a big thing for this team. But Kunin has just taken his game to another level. And, of course, what you can't hear on that call, unless you were sort of you rolled it back a little bit more, is Luke Kunin broke his stick earlier on the play on the near side of the arena as we were looking from the press box, or on the, you know, if you're watching on TV, he's got to skate all the way over to the bench and get another stick from Pete Rogers, then get back in the play. And I think if you slow it down, what you see is Kyle Yarncroak, who's such a smart player, he gets the puck on the half wall, and he's looking where Luke Kunin probably would be had he not broke his stick. And that would be in front of the net, right? And he's thinking, let me just shoot it to the net, see if Kunin can tip it. He looks. He doesn't see anybody there. So instead, he makes a smart play. He puts it around the boards behind the net to Granlund. And right as the timing works out, Granlund receives that pass. Just as Kunin is coming back in, it is clear that Carolina just, in the time that Kunin went to the bench, they just lost track of him for a minute, right? Which is naturally can happen. And then here he comes with full head of steam, and the perfect pass hits him, and he makes a perfect finish. What an incredible way to end it. That's why they gave Pete Rogers the big round of applause in the post-game celebration.
Well, Pete Rogers certainly great at what he does for the Nashville Predators, and coming through in the clutch there to help Luke Kunin get down ice with that new stick and bury the double overtime winner. And here was Luke Kunin with Robbie and Rexrode earlier this morning talking about that sequence where he gets the stick, he scores the goal, and then he has a celebration where he, you know, kind of reminded some of us of Alexander Radulov tackling Jason Arnott after a big playoff goal back in 2008, where Luke Kunin tackles Alexander Carrier following the winner yesterday afternoon. Here's what Luke Kunin had to say after a question from Joe Rexrode.
Luke, is Alex Carrier okay after that shot into the boards on the celebration? And take us through that play and then that moment and what the feeling is when you play 91 minutes of hockey and finally pull one out like that.
Yeah, it was a great pass. Obviously, good play by Yarny and Granny there. Pete gave me the stick, came down, kind of had no one on me there. It's kind of a funky play when, you know, you kind of get out of the zone like that, coming in, and found a way to get that one through. And then, yeah, you just, so many emotions. You're so excited, and you just, I don't know, you know, your legs are gassed for the overtimes, obviously. Then you find a way to jump, you know, pretty high in the air and take out Carzy like that. But, no, he's good. I was apologizing to him after. I thought we were both going to kind of jump into the boards there. I kind of took him out. But, no, it's fun. We're having a great time, and just happy we got the win.
That was Luke Kunin on Robbie and Rexrode this morning. So, Willie, I don't know if it reminded you of the Radulov celebration with Jason Arnott, but it certainly did me when that happened. But good to see the Preds. Yeah.
2008. It was one game removed, right? Arnott played a whole other game, and then the symptoms caught up to him in Detroit two games later with the series tied at two. So that was – it was in the same area of the ice, too, where that collision took place. So I'm glad to hear that everybody's all right. But yeah, he kind of glossed over Pete Rogers gave me the stick. You know, it is such a talent that those guys have. Like, it's not like Pete Rogers just happens to be holding a stick of Luke Kunin's right? The sticks are all racked up. You got, you know, however many players, you know, five on the ice at one time, but, you know, there's 20 guys that at any one time could break their stick. And so you have to have a system of getting it into his hand in a very, very short period of time. And so it's got to be executed perfectly, and it was. And he's so, I mean, he's done well over, he's probably closing in on 2,000 games now. But, you know, there's an art to that, right? And that's why you never know when that's going to come into play.
And the other thing that cracked me up with the celebration, I didn't realize it until Robbie Stanley was talking about it this morning, where when Cunnan scores, he breaks right behind the net after he scores the goal. Granlund was in the corner, and as Cunnan's skating away from him, Granlund is like hopping like two or three times in celebration, and then skates over to the pile that Cunnan and Carrier have created because Cunnan just tackled Carrier, and Granlund is going over there. He's pumping his arms, and it's like, you know, that saying of I don't know what to do with my hands. Like he didn't really know who to hug or you know, what to do. He was just so excited. Granlund's response on the celebration was cracking me up this morning.
Oof. There were so many priceless pictures in a moment like that. And that's why you love it. You know, you never know how long it's going to go before you have that moment,
yep.
Right? And all of a sudden, there it is.
No doubt. Willie Donick here with us on Preds Insiders. Ryan Porth here with you as well. Preds Insiders brought to you every week by Dr. Kelly Rice. For all your dental or sleep apnea needs, visit kellyerice.com. So Luke Cunnan scores the goal to tie the series at 2 games apiece. What I thought was a game where Carolina vastly outplayed Nashville in the first half of the game, and then the Preds started to turn the tides a little bit, starting there in the third period and into overtime, where it was more of an even playing field and not as tilted in favor of Carolina. But game three, I thought, was a pretty evenly played game most of that night, Willie, as you know, they traded goals back and forth, instant classic, game tied 4-4, and then Matt Duchene had the big moment late into double overtime.
Lobs it toward the line. Here's Duchene breaking in. He scores! Matt Duchene wins it in double overtime! The Predators win it 5-4! Holy cow! Go Ape, everybody!
Go Ape, indeed. Smashville going crazy with the Matt Duchene goal, as it felt like that goal essentially saved their season and not going down 0-3 to the Carolina Hurricanes. And Willie, I said this yesterday on Preds Extra with Caroline Fenton, that I was so happy for Matt Duchene that he was able to have that moment, because I know it's been a frustrating time so far in Nashville with the lack of production, and he's felt all season long that he's been snake bitten at different times. He went through the injury earlier this year. He's been up and down the depth chart. And then for him to get that moment Friday night where he's the star of the show, he's the first star, he's the one that everybody's going crazy for after the goal. I felt really happy for Duchene in that moment.
I think Joe Rexroad wrote in his account after game three, if I remember correctly, he said, you know, if you could get that kind of play from him, it's not just a game changer, it's a series changer. And I think to this point, I think he's dead on right, because what's happened so far with the line put together of Johansson, Duchene, and Forsberg, it's given them a line that has driven some possession, which they desperately needed. Not just a chance to score some goals, which is huge, but also take a little heat off of the rest of the team. Because as you mentioned, Ryan, from a Corsi perspective, right, shot attempts. And I think you knew this was going to be the case going into the series, because Carolina does this to everybody. They're going to have more shot attempts than you do. It's just flat out the way it's going to be. But what the Predators have done a pretty good job of is keep the quality of those shot attempts to about as a minimum as you can hope for against a dynamic offensive team. And that has been the case. If you just go by, hey, look at the shot attempts, you would say, wow, this game really looks one-sided. How in the world did the Predators even be in this game? But if you look a little closer at the quality of the chances, it's not nearly as one-sided as the shot attempts would tell you. So there's a lot of analytics involved here. But what Duchesne and Johansson and Forsberg are doing is they are putting a lot of heat. They're putting a lot of heat on the Carolina defenders. And that is helping immensely, I think, level the playing field between these two teams on paper.
Well, and the top line that you're talking about with those three put together have been a much bigger threat out there on the ice at 5-on-5 than the Joffre line was in game one or two in Carolina.
It's night and day.
Yes, for sure. So I would have to think that that's going to stay together at least for next game and probably into game six. And if the Preds have found something here with that top line, then I think that I like their chances better if that top line is rolling than if they had stuck with Joffre and the results weren't what they have been over the years, like it was in games one and two. I really like their chances of pulling this up to that if that line can continue to be effective even in Carolina without John Hines having the last change.
The last change will make it a little tougher. The other thing we have to watch is what is the condition of Jacob Slavin, right? Does Rod Brind'Amour have him available at all? But I think it's a no-brainer. Those three will be together until it doesn't work.
Right.
They've been that good in these last couple of games. And, you know, what's also happened, we know part of the story is they changed completely the power play units, both of them, and Johansson and Duchesne are on neither one. But what they're doing is they're coming out right after the power play's over, and that helps keep the pressure going against Carolina. These are all things that have helped alleviate what Carolina does to you night in and night out as a team, and that is just overwhelm you and smother you in every facet of the game. Like, they don't even call it penalty killing for Carolina. They call it power killing, right? They're used to putting pressure on you when you're on the power play. And that has changed. At least it changed in the two games in Nashville. The personnel changes that John Hines made, they got a power play goal in each game, but more so, Carolina got nothing in terms of shorthanded chances. There was no pressure being put on the defense. And they got momentum out of their power play. And so that was a complete turnaround. Now let's see how it looks in Raleigh in game five. But that is, I think, another thing that they have adjusted since the series started that is helping them a lot give themselves a chance.
Yeah, that took a 180-degree turn from what it was in game two, where they went 0-for-7 on the power play, and I think the Canes had seven chances, or at least it felt like it in game two.
Oh, they had more, chances than the Predators. There's no question.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, the Preds could barely even set up in the offensive zone.
It was a mismatch.
In game two. So, looks like John Hines has, at least for the short term, figured out something with the power play. And then, Willie, just wrapping up the conversation on games three and four, as a twosome, we'd be remiss to not mention UC Saros. UC Saros, 110 saves in the two games, including a franchise record 58 in game four yesterday. And he's the first goalie since Curtis Joseph in 1993 to have back-to-back 50-plus save games in the playoffs. I mean, I know he gave up seven goals between the two games, but you couldn't tell it by the way he played. UC Saros was spectacular in these last two games, and especially last three games if you factor in game two. He's been one of the best players on the ice for the Preds in this series.
He's the most important player. He elevates his team, I think, more than any goalie for his team. And that's saying something, right? I don't know what it's going to look like when all these playoffs are over. But from mid-March on, and I think you could back it up, he was starting to get it, right, before he got hurt by Nino Niederreiter in that game. I think it was March the 2nd. Right, he had played great back-to-back games against Columbus,
yep.
Both wins. Then he gets hurt, and he's got to sort of start all over. But he has elevated this team. He gives them a chance. You ask, okay, how do you win a series when the shot counter looks like it does and the shot attempts look like they do? Well, it's because you have a goalie that has erased mistakes. He's been rock solid. And like we said before, they're giving him a chance, right, by not giving up a lot of grade A chances. Or, you know, the grade A chances came on the shorthanded situation in game two. That's where they got the most grade A chances, I think, in the series. And then in game one, they had breakdowns in the third period, gave up a couple grade A's there. That's one where, you know, that they were much better at avoiding giving up those kind of chances the last two games. So, no question. Saros, how about 38 saves in overtime?
Unbelievable.
In the two games in overtime.
Unbelievable. And at the same time, though, I would say the Preds defensively as a unit played pretty darn well in front of Saros, too, in the overtime sessions. It didn't ever really feel like he was under siege for a long period of time. Like, there were some sneaky chances, some shots from the outside, but, I mean, it didn't feel like he had to stand on his head in overtime like we've had to see Pecorine do in past postseasons.
Well, again, we go back to the John Hines system. Why was John Hines hired? I think that is something that he has put in that they pride themselves on now. Their defensive system is predicated on protecting the middle, right? Not giving up a lot in the home plate area right in front of the goal where the highest percentage of goals are scored. Or letting passes go from one side to the other for one-timers, right? You got to protect the middle. Can't let the puck get passed through the middle. So when they have been, you know, grinded, and there was a moment in the first overtime yesterday, it was unbelievable. Both teams went through it where, you know, both teams were cycling and the other team was completely gassed, you know, just barely could even move. But they protect that house, you know, and they circle the wagons. And they find a way to survive. That's what a lot of these games are about. But you're right. They tried it. By their system, they're pretty good at being reliable of protecting the house. But it's a constant threat when you play against Carolina.
He's Willie Donick. I'm Ryan Porth. Coming up next on Preds Insiders, we take a look ahead to Game 5. What are some burning questions for the Preds? What are some burning questions for the Canes going into the all-important Game 5 with the series tied at 2-2, and the Game 5 winner usually has about an 80% chance of winning the series when the series is tied at 2 going into a Game 5. So a huge game tomorrow night. Pre-game begins at 6. The puck drop is at 7, even though it's in Carolina, so a little bit of a later start time on the East Coast, but a normal start time here in Central Time. And coming up next, we'll break down that Game 5 between the Preds and the Canes. You're listening to Preds Insiders here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in, Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Ryan Porth alongside the TV voice of the Nashville Predators, Willie Donick. The TV voice of the Carolina Hurricanes is coming up in the next segment, Mike Maniscalco. So we'll get the Carolina perspective with him coming up here in a matter of about 10-15 minutes. But Willie, Game 5 tomorrow night, we all know it's a very important game within a series whenever the series is tied 2-2, and this is now the fifth time where the Predators have come back from an 0-2 series deficit, coming back home for Games 3 and 4, where they have tied it at 2. They did it in 0-4 against Detroit. They did it in 0-8 against Detroit. They did it in 2016 against San Jose, and then they did it against Pittsburgh in 2017 in the Cup Final, and now they've done it here in 2021 against the Carolina Hurricanes. And one thing that I feel like has been a little bit of a common thread in these Game Fives for the Preds over the years is that whenever they had that Game Five, it felt at times like the moment may have been too big for them, or at least it came across that way because they flat out did not play well in three of those four Game Fives in those memories. So how do you expect this team to respond? Two emotional, dramatic wins on home ice. You're going back to a place where you haven't won a game all season. You haven't had a lot of success in that building, quite frankly, in the team's history, especially here in the last 5 years or so. So how do you feel like this team is going to respond tomorrow night and, you know, try to maybe have a little bit of a, you know, amnesia to forget about games 3 and 4 and zero in on game 5 here?
You know, it's a great historical point. I'm thinking back. I think I was at all of those game 5s I remember the first one. You know, the very first playoff team the Predators had, 2004. All psyched up. You've even the series. The first two games at Joe Louis Arena against that Red Wings team, the underdog Predators were right in both of those games. And you're thinking, ooh, all right, let's see what happens. You got the momentum. And it was no contest. They got blown away. And I was like, wow, that's a rude awakening right there. So you're right. They haven't played well in some of those game fives. You know, the one out in I didn't get to go to was that San Jose one back in 2016.
Correct.
But that didn't go very well either. But I would guarantee you, if you polled the players that were not on the teams of 2016, 2017, they would have no idea what that stat was, right? So is there really any significance to that stat? I don't know. I don't think that there is, honestly. But the last thing you ask, you know, what are some of the things they have to be thinking about? You know, that's really the key, is trying to figure out a formula for a breakthrough in a very, very tough building to win where you don't have the last change, right? And the matchups can be dictated a little bit more by the Hurricanes, who do have an extremely deep team, right? So I think that's where the game is going to be won and lost.
And I'll be interested to see if John Hines makes any changes to his lineup. I mean, I assumed after game three, the fact that they won and played pretty well in that game, that John Hines wouldn't make a change going into game four, but he did, putting Matthew Olivier in there, taking out Tanner Jeannot. Do you expect any changes for game five? Do you feel like Tanner Jeannot could be an option to go back in there for Olivier? I don't know if you touch the third pair with the way that Benning and Harper have played here in the last couple of games. I think Benning has been very good, you know, logging a lot of minutes on that third pair. So I don't know how many changes could be made, but I will be interested to see if Hines makes any.
There's been a change, at least one change for every game, correct?
Correct.
I think that there's a chance there will be an adjustment or two. Not very many, but looking at a couple things, and it may not be with a different guy. It could be just maybe a tweak in the line combinations. For example, you know, what was the threesome that won the game was a reunited Luke Cunningham, Mikhail Granlund, and Cali Yarncroak, right? That line got broken up. They got outplayed pretty badly in game one. Remember, they were sort of a staple. They were the glue kind of line for the last several weeks of the season as the team, you know, charged into the playoffs. I mean, you could not have been more reliable than those three. But then Yarncroak got sick, missed game two. That necessitated a breakup. They put Tolvanen in there. And then by the end of the game, I think by the end of the game, they had switched back. But I don't know if they're going to stick with that, but that's something to look for, right? They have had Granlund go up against Aho as much as they possibly can. It takes everything that you've got to contain Aho, Svechnikov, and Teravainen. That's an unreal line, right? Svechnikov, when he gets going, what are you going to do, right? I mean, it's the same thing with Aho. And in the open ice, it takes everything you got to stay in front of those guys. And, you know, their creativity they have, the way they can, you know, transition from defense to offense, make the cross-ice pass, high-skill one-timers, that's a tough, tough assignment. So who do you want to go with there? Do you want to go back with Granlund, Cunning, and Yarncroak? That's something to look at. And then the other thing I was thinking was with the herd, do you want to maybe – because analytics are not favoring that group, right? They've done some good things. They've shown up here and there. But over the course of the game, they have not had the upper hand in terms of possession time. When they're on, what are they doing? They're grinding in the offensive zone. They're forcing you to defend them. They're chipping in a goal here and there. Even if you don't score, it's setting up the next line. There's been less of that in the series. And they certainly haven't had as many of the blow-up hits that impact games that maybe you envision going into the series. So would they consider taking out a rookie like an Olivier or a Jeannot and inserting a guy like Brad Richardson in there to give you a little bit more experience, a little more guile, and maybe a little more reliability. I don't know. I mean, I just think it, the other thing to think about, Ryan, is one thing John Hines has done to utilize the depth that he has, now that he has more healthy bodies, he's put it out there for everybody. He basically says, you know what, we got guys that are just chomping at the bit to get into this lineup. They can't wait. They think they should be in there. They're ticked off that they're not in there, even though they've accepted their role. So if you're not playing well, I got another guy over here, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if he keeps that going. Like, Nick Cousins wasn't in there to start the series, but he's made a very big impact.
He ain't
on
coming
the last,
out.
Last two games.
Yeah, he's not coming out. I mean, Nick Cousins.
Well, we know
been,
he's not coming out now.
Right, right? Exactly.
But they decided not to use him in games 1 and 2.
Right. Well, you've seen Cousins come in and play well. Matt Benning did not dress in game 1. I have been perfectly fine with what Matt Benning has brought to the table on the third pair. Really, that entire defense corps, ever since game 1, they have just it kind of reminds me of Bulldogs in a pit where they are working like crazy in the defensive zone to make life as miserable as possible for the Hurricanes. And they're not always successful at that. But like Ryan Ellis on the penalty kill has been awesome. Alexander Carrier has been uber impressive here in the playoffs so far. And really, ever since he got reinserted into the lineup back mid-season, Carrier's been awesome. I think Benning's been great. You know, Harper and Branson have had their moments where you're thinking, getting a little dicey. But I thought Harper even yesterday held his own in some key moments. So I don't think, you know, a lot of the changes that we pondered were up front. I don't think Sean Hines touches the defense.
We'll see. I do think that there's been consideration of Fabbro, for sure. Fabbro is way more talented than the guys that they've been using on the third pair. I don't think anybody would argue that. He's also still very young. He hasn't been in the groove down the stretch of the season. He was hurt, right, for a long time, and he sort of lost his role there. And Carrier kind of jumped in there, and he hasn't looked back, right? So I wouldn't be stunned if they gave Fabbro a shot in this game just to see, you know, what it looks like. The thing that I think they really like about Benning and Harper is that's a reliable penalty-killing pair. That's probably the best thing that they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5-on-5, they're going to give up some shots, right? And they're also going to be, you know, in the situation that you see when the third defense pair is out there and you're on the road, you're going to have to, you know, get some stops against Aho. You're going to have to get some stops against Trocheck in those lines, right? Yep. And there's really no escaping that fact. So
yeah.
You know, would they try Fabbro, who might be a little bit more mistake-prone, but also could make a big play? We'll see. We'll see. But I don't think it's a complete, put the same guys in there. I don't know. They'll probably consider a couple different things.
He's Willie Donick. He's the co-host of Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Also the TV voice for the Nashville Predators. Willie, thank you, as always, for your time. I know you logged a lot of minutes behind a mic, not only Friday night, yesterday afternoon, but 4 hours today. So I appreciate your time.
No problem. Little Gatorade, little tea and honey, and then shut her down for the rest of tonight. Come out swinging tomorrow. We'll be ready to go.
I'm taking notes as you say that. Willie Donick, great stuff as always. Coming up next, it will be the TV voice of the Carolina Hurricanes. Mike Maniscalco will get his perspective on the series so far and what to expect from the Hurricanes. How will they deal with this pressure that will be certainly on them coming up here in Game 5 as the series shifts back to Raleigh, tied 2 games apiece? That's coming up next here on Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Preds Insiders here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Ryan Porth here with you on this Monday evening, getting you set for Game 5 of the Preds-Hurricanes series, with the series now tied at 2 games apiece after the Preds took Games 3 and 4 at home. The home team has won each of the first 4 games of this Round 1 series, and joining us now to give us the perspective from the Carolina side of things is their TV voice, Mike Maniscalco. Mike, thank you so much for joining us here this evening.
No, Ryan, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, before we get into games 3 and 4 themselves and looking ahead to game 5 from the Hurricanes' perspective, I mean, how nice is it to not only be in the building on your end of things in Raleigh, but to also see what's going on in Nashville and, you know, be a part of a playoff series that is the highest attended series, highest attended hockey games so far this season, that the Carolina Hurricanes' great fan base can be in their arena enjoying this playoff series. The Predators fans can be in Bridgestone Arena, and that, you know, there's a sense of normalcy as the playoffs get started here.
No, absolutely, Ryan. And, you know, I've been asked that a couple of times, and the answer is the same thing. And I don't know how you felt about it, because I know you were in the building, but it really, for me, was one of those moments where you don't realize what's missing until it's gone, and then you get it back, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's how this is supposed to be. And the amazing thing for me is they're not even completely full buildings, but I have a hard time remembering PNC Arena and Bridgestone Arena, for fact of that matter, being louder than what they have been in these last four games, you know, the two in Raleigh and the two in Nashville. And that's just 12,000 people and 12,000 plus for you guys. And it's great to be a part of it. And I can tell you, for games one and two here in Raleigh, it brought something special. And not just for the players, I think for everybody who was there, from the parking attendants to the broadcasters, you know, there was a little bit something extra there. Like, oh yeah, that's what this is all about. That's why we do all of these things. And it's just great to see. And I do think that it makes this series special. And I've gone on record before that the two teams that feed the most off of their crowd in a positive way in the National Hockey League, it's the Carolina Hurricanes and the Nashville Predators. So it's no surprise to me that both teams have held serve at home when they've been allowed to have more fans in the building than what they've had at any point in time this past year.
Hurricanes TV voice Mike Maniscalco on the line with us here on Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game. So, Mike, let's get into what occurred over the weekend, Friday night and Sunday afternoon here in Smashville, where the Preds took away two double overtime instant classics for the Nashville Predators. And it's one of those things in playoff hockey where if the Hurricanes had gotten two bounces, this series could be over after coming to Nashville with a 2-0 series lead, but it's going back to Raleigh with the series all knotted at two. How do you feel like this Hurricanes team is going to respond to now the pressure that is on them going back for game five?
I think they'll respond how they've responded all year. This is a team that's been really resilient. And, you know, just take a look at how these games have played out. And for me, these two in Nashville were like a prize fight. You know, one team lands a huge punch and you think the other team's on the ropes and about ready to get knocked out, and they come right back and throw a huge punch. I think the Canes are fine. When people are talking about pressure, there's no pressure on this team. It's now just a best of three series, and the Canes have home ice advantage for that. And this is a group, and it's a comment from earlier in the season. And Ryan, take it for what it's worth, but it's truly the mark of this team. Rod Brindamore was talking about how the Canes were down 2-0 in a game, and then they stormed back, had a great third period. I believe it was against the Columbus Blue Jackets, and, you know, they win the game. And the head coach of this team said they don't realize, and I don't know if this is a problem or not, but they don't realize that the situation is this. You know, they look up, they're like, all right, we need to score two goals. All right, let's go out and score two goals. Like, they don't get panicked. They don't get down. And this is a team, if we're going to be realistic about it, like you said, both of these games in Nashville were a coin flip. So Carolina could have easily been coming back to Raleigh up 3-1, or maybe the series is closed out. You know, if you can get to double overtime on the road against a good opponent, you just want a chance to win in those games. And the Canes have been without their best defenseman, Jacob Slavin, although I've said this before, I might have to start walking that back with how good Brett Pesce has been for the Hurricanes, and we know how good he is here. But he stepped up. Brady Shea has stepped up. So, you know, if you put everything all together, how the Canes played in Nashville, this is a team that I don't think is frustrated that they lost two games to the Predators. I think that, you know, they're frustrated that they played well enough to win, but it's not like they're coming back here and thinking, oh, the world's against us and what are we going to do now? They know if they play their game, and in particular, if they played like they did in game four, they'll be fine. And that's the mindset of this team. And I will say the word again, they are a resilient group. So I don't think they're feeling any pressure right now, if there is any pressure on this club to, oh, you have to win here in game five in your building.
As the team's captain, how much does Jordan Staal help with that? The fact that he's been through all the battles, you know, dating back to his days with the Pittsburgh Penguins. He wins the Stanley Cup there. He has a ton of experience in the NHL. How much does having a captain like Jordan Staal help with moments like this?
Almost hard to put in words, but you have to have guys who've been there and done it. And the fact that Jordan Staal, that was his 100th playoff game yesterday, has been through all of that. He has a great read of the room. And it was actually said today that when the head coach leans on the captain, like, you know, should we practice? Shouldn't we practice? The captain is the one who will go and say, look, I think we need to practice today, or no, you know, give us the day off, or this is where the room is at. And I hate to date myself with this one, Ryan, but it's the old E.F. Hutton commercials. He doesn't say a lot, but when Jordan Staal talks, everybody in that locker room listens, and he sets the pace. And he can tell this group, because, you know, in particular, winning a Stanley Cup, he can tell them, you know, don't worry, because we're back here at 2-2. If we just handle our business, everything will be fine. And you cannot put a value on having guys who know the moment, can read the moment, and can relay that to their teammates of, don't panic, just play our game, we'll be fine. What that can do, especially for the young guys in that room. And you know, this is a group that has really grown together the last 3 years. So to have the one voice that, if, you know, they're looking around going, you know, what should we do now, to have that guy step up and say, or more importantly, lead the way with his play, with what he does, that's something that'll carry, I think, a really, really far way for this Carolina Hurricanes team.
Were you surprised by the comments from Rod Brind'Amour following Game 3 regarding the officiating?
No, not at all. And I would back everything that he said, because if the shoe was on the other foot, the Nashville Predators would want John Hines to say the same thing. And I think one of the things that got taken out of context is people think that it was, you know, ripping on the officials for the calls that were made. And I don't think that's it at all. I don't think that at any point Rod Brind'Amour said, you know, my team's not committing penalties and they're making it. It's not that. I think it's just, you watch the game, it's so close. Both teams are doing these things. Why is one getting whistled 7 times and one's getting whistled 3? So no, I had no problem with it. If anything, to remove myself from the broadcaster role and try to put myself in the locker room for a player, that I want my coach to say that. And I think every fan out there agrees with this. And one of the things that I've always tried to do when comments are made are be, you know, try to be impartial to it, Ryan. Mm-hmm. And if it was 2 games in a row where the Canes got 7 power plays and the Predators only got 3, if I'm a Predators fan, or more importantly, a guy who wears the sweater for the Preds, John Hines better say something. And I think that the way that Rod Brind'Amour said it, look, I know Nashville fans, and I'm on a Nashville radio station right now. I know you guys are going to take it, and how you want to interpret it as fans, go right ahead and do it. But it wasn't a, hey, these are non-calls, or these are bad calls. It's we're making penalties here, but how come I'm seeing the team across the way do the same thing and they're not getting the whistle? So sometimes you got to do that. Look, it's part of the gamesmanship of the playoffs, and Rod Brind'Amour wasn't the only guy who did it. You know, Craig Berube did it for St. Louis, and I'm not trying to say, oh, it's okay because these guys did it, but Craig Berube said it. John Cooper said it. Things have been said, and when you feel that there's an opportunity to make a comment and you know, defend your guys, your team, you have to do it. So, no, I had absolutely no problem with it. I think the way he said it was absolutely perfect. There's nothing that I would have him change about those comments. And, again, I think it's something that just as a sports fan, you want your coach to do for your team, for your players, if you feel something's not right. I don't think that he was looking to try to make something up and try to spark it, because if you remember, you know, it's still a 2-1 series lead for the Canes after game number 3. So, no. I know that I've just given you a very long answer, and I could have given you a short one there, Ryan, but no, I had no problem whatsoever with what Rod Brind'Amour had to say.
Well, and when he said those comments Friday night and I saw them, I had chuckled to myself and I said, well, now that that's out there, I guarantee you Carolina's going to get the first power play on Sunday. You know, that's just kind of how this works over the years with the NHL. And there they were. They got the first 2 power plays on Sunday. I don't know how much those words had influence on that, but I just found it funny.
No, I know. But if we could go back, I hate to do this, but, I mean, how did Preds fans feel when the Tim Peel story went public, when we could hear that? You know, you're thinking, oh, the refs are out to get us. And, you know, so – You know, it's again, and I'll go from, allow me not to be the play-by-play voice of the Carolina Hurricanes. Let me be a fan for a second. Every fan thinks that the refs are out to get them in some way, shape, or form. We know it's not true, but when, you know, it's one of the things that's convenient to do. I think that the referees in the NHL do the absolute best job of all of the professional sports, because it is the hardest sport to officiate in real time. And again, if I could go back, now I'll be the broadcaster for the Carolina Hurricanes and defend Rod Brindamore. I think that that's really one of the things, because if you're around him, he wants to get more help for the officials. He wants to give them more access to replays for things that happen, because the game happens so fast that give them the ability to go back and see if that's a penalty or not a penalty, and help them out. So that's just kind of the way it is. But, you know, we've been at this for a while, Ryan. I know I have. You know, the one thing that is in common of every fan base is the guys in the striped shirts usually seem to have an agenda against their team. But that's not what Rod Brindamore was stating. He was just stating, look, this is an even series, but at the end of these last two games, or games two and three, I'm trying to figure out why the penalties are more 2-1 in favor of one team.
And we all know those feelings are not exclusive to the sport of hockey either. Mike Maniscalco here with us, TV voice of the Carolina Hurricanes here on Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Mike, you mentioned the fact that they don't have Jacob Slavin right now. And yes, they have other more than capable defenders. You mentioned Brett Pesce. Feel like he's one of the most underrated defensemen across the league. Dougie Hamilton, Brady Shea. They've got a lot of really good defensemen on that blue line. But at the same time, how much do you feel like they are missing Slavin?
Oh, I don't know if there's an exact number I can put on it, or value system, other than when you take a look at it, it takes a lot of the rotation that you want from your D pairings out of whack, just simply because of when you do have all of these special teams that has to be put on the ice. You're going to get a couple of mixes when you've got to go back on, because, you know, Jake Bean might not be killing the penalty the way that Jacob Slavin would, and what it does for your defensive pairings, and also what it does with your just regular group. Jacob Slavin and Dougie Hamilton play really well off of each other, because Jacob Slavin has a good read for how Dougie Hamilton wants to play. It allows Dougie Hamilton to be a completely different player, and it kind of changes the players will never admit this, but it kind of changes how they view what they're supposed to do on the ice. And not that Brady Shea and Dougie Hamilton are a bad pairing for the Canes by any mean, but Dougie Hamilton plays a little bit different with Brady Shea to his left than when Jacob Slavin's there, because Jacob Slavin, much like Brett Pesce, does so many things that do not show up on the box score at the end of the night. But the minutes that he plays, the way that he gets into passing lanes and deflects pucks, and just little plays that you don't notice. And he's not a monster. You know, he's not a physical, you know, player who's going to run somebody through the boards. He's very much like Roman Josi, only, you know, maybe not with the offensive numbers that Roman puts up, but the way that when Roman Josi is defending, you know, he's never going to deliver that thunderous check that, you know, you look at and everybody gets off of their feet for it, even though he's a guy who's capable of doing it. It's just his stick's always in the right spot. He lets whoever is playing next to him play at a different level, because this guy's going to cover everything that we need on the ice. And it's funny, because I've been watching that since John Hines split up Ellis and Josi, and he put Alexander Carrier with Roman Josi. You're sitting here going, how's a rookie going to play? You know, how is Roman Josi going to play any different? He's allowed Carrier to be a factor. That's what Jacob Slavin does. He allows the guy who plays next to him to play a little bit different. They can be more aggressive offensively. They can do what they need to do. So the Canes are clearly missing him. And just go back to game one when Slavin did play, to see how effective he is getting in shooting lanes, getting in the passing lanes, and just always it's a surprise when he is not in the right position to make a play. So he's day-to-day, and it's up to him with what he's dealing with, if he feels he can play or if he can't. But the Canes clearly are a much better team with him in the lineup than, you know, having to figure out where do the minutes go without him.
Mike Maniscalco is the TV voice for the Carolina Hurricanes. Mike, thank you so much for your time here on Preds Insiders this evening, and enjoy the rest of this best of three now series between the Preds and the Canes.
And think about it. We've already had three games in two nights, so who knows what's going to happen tomorrow night.
Get ready for another double overtimer tomorrow night.
Oh, I have all of my water and lozenges ready to go. So
awesome. Mike, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ryan.